Hey, what's up, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Let There Be Talk. Today is Thursday, September 8th, and this is a special episode. It's going to be a combo episode with Jamcast, Mike Fenoya's Jamcast. I did it, recorded it about a month ago in New York, which, by the way, I'm going back to New York, pretty fired up. I'll be in New York mid-October, like the 10th through the 18th. So I'll get you some venues shortly. But listening to this podcast, I listened back to it, and I was pretty, it took me right back to New York City, which is cool. I'm dying to get back there. I'm trying to go there every other month now and just do stand-up. Anyway, like I said, special episode today. It's a joint episode between myself and Mike Fenoya, New York comedian who has a great podcast called Jamcast, and we get down on this episode and talk a lot of Grateful Dead and stand-up. I don't talk a lot of stand-up on this podcast because everybody seems to talk about stand-up, but when I do, I love to dive deep into it, and it was excellent to talk about it. It's my favorite thing on the planet to do, obviously. This episode is brought to you by my fantastic sponsor, El Cajon Harley Davidson. El Cajon Harley Davidson, you got to get yourself a motorcycle. If you live in California, get your ass down to Southern California, El Cajon Harley, my favorite Harley dealer on the planet. And how cool is it of them to sponsor this podcast? I don't care where you live, actually. Call them up. They'll get you a great fucking deal. Get your ass out to El Cajon. Ask for Greg. Say, hey, man, I heard about it on the podcast. I want to get a motorcycle, or I want to get my bike serviced, or I want to get some sneakers, boots, hats, helmets, shirts, whatever. They got all kinds of motor clothes in there. Harley makes everything, man. They're like Kiss. They just, whatever they put their name on, you know, it's a Harley product. Here it is, Harley underwear. They got Harley underwear, I'm sure. Speaking of Harley, too, I just took a couple days off. I got home from Arizona, which, by the way, thanks for all the love on that Rich Robinson episode. It was just insane, insane dream come true guest, and you guys loved it, too, which was really fucking cool. But I came home from Arizona and then went out and rode the brand new Harley Davidson. I've talked about it for the last 3 weeks. But they have a new motor, and I got to really dive in deep and ride it. And let me tell you, these guys hit a fucking home run with this motor, man. I've got a Harley Road King. It's got a 103 motor. It's a 2013, and the difference, I'm sorry, 2014. And I had a 13 before. And the difference between Harley on 13 and 14 was pretty monumental, man. They had changed the frame, the controls were different, and they had a 103 motor, and it was fast and kick-ass, and I was like, oh, I gotta have this. And now the difference between my 14 and the new 17 is, I can't even tell. It's like having a Hemi now. This thing, look, I've owned a lot of bikes. I've owned Ducatis, Beamers, Harleys, of course, all different styles of bikes, everything. But this was like my favorite bike I've rode in years. It's so smooth and so fast. The shifting's amazing. The motor, you know, like I said before, it was rubber mounted before, but then they threw a counterbalancer in there too. So when you're at the light, stoplight, your motor's not shaking out of the fucking bike. And then the suspension, man, I was just hitting turns, just doing like 80, man. Just, it is incredible. Harley hit a home run, man. So get your ass to, down to Elko and Harley and ride one of these things. They'll let you test ride one, man. I gotta have it. I'm going New Road King. I'm gonna go Ape Hangers this time. I'm going old school 60s biker. Ape Hangers. Just fucking cruiser. I've been trying to find the ultimate bike where I can just sit on it. I used to have an Ultra Classic, and I rode that thing all over the United States. And I'm trying to go Ultra Classic comfort without the giant old fairing on the front. I'm not a fan of the fairing. I like the Road King. It's like a big FXR. If you don't ride, it's all foreign language to you, but basically it's an amazing bike, so I'm pretty fired up. And it was fun, man. I rode down the PCH, out the one, all the way up to, where did I go, Santa Maria, cut over to Pismo Beach, San Simeon, one of those sands. Have you ever been to Hearst Castle? I don't know if I've talked about it because I've done so many episodes, but Hearst Castle is so fucking cool, man. And it's, if you live in LA or California, go do it, man. Or even if you're visiting California, a lot of people are like, yeah, I got to see this and that. Go see Hearst Castle. It is unbelievable, this place. It is just straight up. It's funny. I was thinking, like, he built this mansion. Beyond mansion. It's beyond mansion. He built this massive castle in the middle of nowhere, which is about 3.5 hours outside of L.A. And he said, I built it so I could have great, lavish Hollywood parties and have all my friends up there. And I'm like, who the fuck would be going out there? Especially back then, it's like, you got the slowest car, take hours to get out of there. I got rich friends in Malibu that have mansions on the beach, and I don't even go out there, it seems far. I couldn't imagine back in the day. And back then, people just driving home fucking drunk from Hearst Castle, 4-hour ride. Yeah, we got this, man, down a windy-ass fucking hill, dodging his fucking zoo animals. He's got like zebras and tigers and lions and giraffes up there and shit. You're just drunk driving home. Anyway, get out there and see this fucking place, man. It is just beautiful and it's cheap. They got like 4 tours. The place is so big. They got one just, the tour I would recommend is the one where they just kind of skim you through everything so you can get a good idea of the place. You want to see the 2 swimming pools, the indoor gold bottom 24 karat gold bottom pool, and then the outside one that's just like, sometimes when I'm at the outside pool, it's got like those Greek statues and shit, naked men with the tiny packages. Why do those Greek statues always have the tiny package? That's so bummer for that statue. Just put some fucking man cocks on them out there. Anyway, sometimes when I'm hanging out at that pool, it's creepy. I'm like, man, did I die? What is going on? Anyway, rambling. I want to get to the episode. I want to say thank you to everybody that emailed me. And with all your cool love that you gave me over the diabetes and the motorcycle crash and all that stuff. Thank you so much. One quick last thing. I will be on the road over the next couple weeks. Let's see, North Carolina coming to Durham with Bill Burr, September 15, 16, 17. What else I got? Oh, Edmonton, going to be headlining the comic strip September 28th through October 2nd, Edmonton, Canada. Get your tickets. Come out and see me. Don't fucking sleep. I don't know when I'll be in Edmonton again, so you don't... Don't skip and go, I'll catch you next time, because, you know, there might not be a next time. Edmonton. Unless it's crazy packed and I love it, then I'll be all over it again. I'm looking forward to that, actually. That's about it right now for the road shows. Like I said, come see me open for Bill Burr in Durham. That's going to be incredible. Kick back and enjoy this. Have a great weekend. Happy Thursday to you guys. Candles lit.
What's up, brother?
Yeah, all right. Here we are, another episode of Let There Be Talk. This is an unusual episode. It's going to be a duo episode. I've done it before with Jim Florentine, yeah. Where I released it the same day on my podcast as his. And now we're going to do yours, Jamcast. Introduce yourself.
Everybody, welcome to another episode of Jamcast. It's your host, Mike Fenoia. We're going to be doing a different thing this week. We're going to be doing a hybrid episode with Let There Be Talk with my guest and host of his podcast, Let There Be Talk.
Let There Be Jam Talk.
Yes, let there be jams.
Let There Be Jam Talk.
I love it, man. It's perfect. Dude, it's such a pleasure to meet you, and I'm so happy that you... You're here in New York this week, and we've had a lot of time to chill, man.
Yeah, pretty amazing. I've been talking about it over and over on my podcast. The love in this city is awesome. Mm. And, of course, there's no snow or wind or rain, so I think that has a lot to do with it.
Yeah,
I've been here in the winter, man.
True.
No one's stopping to talk to anybody. It's like, I got to get fucking moving, you know?
Absolutely. You know, it's a smelly time of year here, for sure.
Oh, God.
I spent a week, in mid-July, I went to Chicago for a week and did a bunch of shows. I did Zany's and Laugh Factory and a whole bunch of the produced shows. And it was hot as shit, but what a clean city and what a fun, like, welcoming community, you know? And we were just talking before we started about how nice it is to, like, find other people in other places that just love and do the same things that you love and do.
I love it. It's so funny because immediately everybody wants to know, hey, it's way better here then, huh? Or, you know what I mean? Like, it's some competition.
It's so weird, man.
It's so weird to think that, you know, music or comedy or whatever is like, it's got to be put in some kind of competition for people to... You know what I look at it as? I think Ari Shaffir is the genius, and now my gears are running of, I must live bi-coastal.
Yeah, totally. He's smart. He's got a great place here in Alphabet City. He's got his place there, and it works out perfectly. And you're right. He is a genius at that, because if you're going to be multifaceted, you kind of need to be... We're functionally bipolar. We're purposefully bipolar as comics. So why not be bi-coastal as well, you know?
Absolutely. And to me, I always like something new. That's why I love comedy. I'm always chasing the new bit. I love new bits more than bits that kill.
Oh, totally.
You know, because to me, I know this bit's going to kill. Where's the thrill in that? I like the danger. And the danger of being in a new city and not knowing people and having to go out and dig into the trenches and meet people and talk and hang.
Totally. And I think that's why I love the music I love, too, is because, you know, it brings me to a new place every time I see a show. I don't like a band where, look, I love and appreciate a show where I know I'm going to go hear the songs I want to hear, and it's kind of, you know, it follows the template, and I can leave going, all right, cool, I saw Hall & Oates, like, maybe I'll catch him again.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to go see 400 Hall & Oates shows.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm a huge Guns N' Roses fan, and I saw four of the shows so far on this run, and of course they've been spectacular and stuff, but I kind of feel like, I've seen it, because they're not changing. These bands that change one song in the set list, I don't have time for it anymore.
Yeah,
because,
man.
There's no mystery, and there's no danger in that. They know exactly where they're coming, and they're going to turn into robots. And it's like when I did comedy after I saw The Dead, Fare Thee Well last year.
Yeah.
I did a full year of just, and I still kind of do it, but I get a little structure, but no structure on stage. No, what I'm starting with, what I'm closing with. And man, did it feel good and fucking crazy. A lot of times you might not get laughs, you know?
Right, of course. And you know, it's a couple things about that I love is, you know, I think as comics, we kind of have to always be preparing for three or four different things. You know, like, for instance, I've got my audition coming up at the Cellar, and I need to get that five tight. I'm working on trying to send a submission to Conan. I got to work on that five clean. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. And you look at it from, I'm heavily like you, and I think that's where we, you know, kind of hit it off right away, is like, I'm heavily influenced by music. And bands got to write their hits, and you know, the Dead had to write, you know, Touch of Grey and, you know, Casey Jones and things like that. But, you know, it's the fun part is when you go on stage and you kind of, yeah, Bobby said it the best, insane of circumstance. I sure don't know what I'm going for, but I'm going to go for it for sure. You know, and it's just that, like, I love the freedom to get on stage and do a half hour, 45, an hour, and that moment's never going to happen again. And it's great when you get a crowd that's willing to take the ride with you.
Yeah.
And that comfort level, it comes with time, you know? And I think that I'm happy to be at that place.
How long have you been doing comedy?
7 years.
Yeah, so we're really kind of the same animal. I'm right at like 6 years, almost 7 years, 6 and a half, you know?
Well, December will be 7.
Yeah,
so,
me too. Yeah. Same thing, December 6.
Oh, no shit. Yeah, okay, so I'm like December 13th or 14th.
And so weird, so we're exactly the same.
That's killer.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because you said the Dead had to write hits, but I definitely know, and I know with every band, unless you're a pop band, you don't sit down to write hits because there's a formula of a pop song, but who the fuck thought Touch of Grey would be a hit?
Well, no, right. One, you know, and you even know? In the early 60s, like The Golden Road, it was one of the first, that's on the first album, and that tended to be kind of like one of those, you know, I think if somebody put together like the psychedelic sound of Haight-Ashbury in the 60s, that would be that like kind of poppy, psychedelic, you know, Bay Area hit of that time.
Yeah,
you're
absolutely
right. The Dead never set out to write a hit, but it's almost like, you know, comics that we respect. And we were talking about this the other day about how, you know, you don't want Nickelback fandom. You want Grateful Dead fan bases where
you want grassroots.
Yeah, and you put out an album and let's say people go, you know what, man, I didn't really dig this album. I can't wait for the next one.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's the type of fans that's the type of fan I am with music. And it's also the type of fans I would like with comedy. You have the privilege of, you know, knowing a lot of, you know, it's fun when where we came in. At our age, we already kind of have a voice and a story and a lifetime of experiences.
Yeah.
And we're not figuring out who we personally are through being on stage.
Absolutely.
We're bringing life with us. And I have the honor of having guys like Okerson and Ari Shaffir and Attell and Metzger and guys that like make me feel safe trying different things. And going on the road with Jay, one time we were in Austin and he goes, "You're so much funnier than your jokes, man." He's like,
"Oh, that's what Ian Edwards said to me."
Yeah, and he goes,
"Same thing."
He goes, "Just go do." And I go, "Now I have this kind of guilt where this isn't my show. They're not there to see Mike Fenoya. They're there to see Jay.
Right?
They paid money. They deserve a professional show. And I'm not going up there and just playing the hits." But he goes, "Man, you could. I know you're funnier than that." And I asked him. I go, "You mind if I just go like throw caution to the wind this next set?" And he goes, "Please go for it." And I did a half hour and I was on the ropes and I had to fight back. And I got off stage and Jay was like, "Dude, that's the most fun I've ever had watching you." He goes, "You're in a new place now, you know, and let's work those jokes and see."
Yeah.
And it's great to have that love and support. And there doesn't need to be that competition.
No.
You know?
When a guy like Okerson or with me, Ian Edwards or Burr or Marin, when guys take the time to tell you something, they see something.
Right.
And they're like, "I don't want this guy to go down a wrong path. I'm going to steer him here and see if he listens."
Exactly.
And it's amazing because I've told the story 100 times, but I thought starting out in comedy, it was just about, you know, getting big laughs and killing. And later on, you find out right away. And the same thing happened to me. Ian told me, "Man, you're way funnier in the hallway than you are on stage." And I was like, "What do you mean? I just killed." And he was like, "Yeah, but with bullshit."
Right.
You know? And I learned right there and I started all over. Now, I don't want to get heavy into that because I've told that story a million times. But yeah, we have so many things alike. It's hilarious.
It really,
man,
is, dude. I'm so glad. I feel like I have a brother on the other coast now, man.
Yeah,
this is
absolutely
wonderful. And I look forward to going through this ride and keeping in touch with you about everything, you know. And there's something about being perfectly imperfect that I really love. I don't want to be perfect. I don't want to go up and do. I was headlining a room somewhere, I think it was St. Louis, and the middle act said to me, "You know, you changed up a whole bunch of your tags and you didn't do the same order that you did last time.
Yeah.
I just wanted to let you know. And I'm like, he said it almost kind of like a favor. Like
yeah.
he was doing me a favor. And I'm like, no, I know. I was like, I don't want to ever do
no.
the same thing. And he goes, really, you can do that? And I'm like, bro, yeah, man. I'm like, and it,
there's no rules.
No. And it's like,
this is comedy.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I don't ever want to see a band that does the same set list. I don't ever want to, you know, and to be able to, but do you know Bob Marley, comedian Bob Marley?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right. So I worked with him early on. He's a big, for people who don't know, he's in like an enormous New England, he's like the king in New England of stand up. And he just does his own thing there. He was in Boondock Saints. He's great. I was doing a set early on opening for him. And I did really well. And I was like, I think this set's good. I'm like, this is tight as shit. I
yeah.
know everything. And he goes, okay, do it backwards.
Oh, yeah.
He goes, open with your closer.
Yeah, CK style.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, Jesus. You know, and he goes, if you could do that, then it's time to start writing some new stuff. And it wasn't like a, you know, stern big brother thing. It was just, we were laughing about
yeah,
how
yeah.
we're never done. Nothing's
nope.
ever done.
No. My you know? Buddy Bronson, I just brought him to feature for me at the Comedy Works. And, the host kept going, is this his closer? Is this his closer? And he goes, I don't know. Because I never know what he's going to start with, and I don't know what he's going to end with.
Right.
And the person just kept, and Bronson just said, just sit down and relax.
Yeah,
it'll
man.
Come. You
yeah,
know?
Totally.
And it's like, I can't do five shows in a weekend and fucking have them the same. I just can't. Plus,
can't.
People come 2-3 times.
Oh, dude, I'll tell you what. So I've been... this past weekend, I'm not sure when this will air, but like early, so the last weekend in July, I did 8 shows. I opened up for the Impractical Jokers on tour, on their
yeah.
theater tour.
That's cool. We'll get into that.
It's great. Yeah. And I, we did 8 shows, 4 shows at Hampton Beach Casino Ballroom, which I've got a great story about. And then 4 shows at Foxwoods. And these two women, beautiful people, real great fans. They went to 7 out of 8 shows.
Yeah.
And they sat in the exact same seats. Now, a little bit of inside.
That'll fuck with you.
Dude, yeah. So a little
wow.
bit of inside baseball for the listeners.
Yeah.
Sometimes when we're on stage and you're doing 6 shows,
oh.
I've got triggers in my mind where if I'm telling a punch, the biggest fear is, oh my God, did I already tell that joke during
this
set?
I was just talking about it last night. Remember whenever they had a 3rd show in the night?
You're like,
you
oh
are
my God.
Fucked.
Especially if you don't do the same order.
Yeah.
Because like if you know, okay, right after this thing about my dad, I talk about medicinal marijuana or
totally.
Whatever. If you always do that, then you don't have any worries. But if you bounce around like we do, I have to have triggers where like I'll look at the crowd, and Jay taught me this, you know, because I asked him once and he goes, here's what you do. When you deliver that punch, look at someone and be like, green sweater.
Yeah.
So then the next time you're on stage, if you pan to that part of the room and you see purple hoodie, you know you didn't repeat it, you
oh.
know? You know what I mean? So it's
oh,
almost
yeah.
give yourself a visual. These women were sitting in the same spot.
That's fucked.
Same clothes, and they're laughing like they heard it for the first time. Dean, it blew my
they
mind.
They got to be freaking out, too, if they come to see me, because I'll be wearing the same clothes,
yeah,
too.
Me, too. I have 3 of the same T-shirt.
Yeah, I go on the road one fucking outfit. I don't give a fuck, man.
Absolutely.
I don't like to carry any bags,
I hate packing.
Man.
I'm a chronic overpacker,
I can't
too.
Stand bags. I'm out for a month on the road now, so I got a bag.
Yeah.
But usually... it's just a backpack with my computer. That's it. I'll go to H&M and buy a couple $5 shirts,
yeah.
some socks, and I'm fucking moving on. I hate carrying stuff on the road.
It's terrible, and I get very I'm chronically overpacking, and I don't know where the hell I got it from. I mean, I'm a minimalist. I think one of the happiest times in my life when I lived in Denver, Colorado, I was leaving Denver to come back east, and I minimized my life to a hockey bag. I had a goalie bag, a big Bauer equipment bag, and I fit all my possessions except my guitar and my TV, and I put it in my car, and I drove around the mountains and up into like Utah, Wyoming, and slowly made my way back east, and I had everything I owned in my trunk, and I was like, man, I could do this the rest of my life.
Yeah, as I've been in New York now for 2 weeks, I always say this on the podcast where I fantasize at any point just tapping out and being in Toto Santos with no one around ever again. But also, as I've been here in New York, I was like, all right, brick little studio
yeah.
apartment, nothing but a bed and records. and a killer leather jacket. Give up everything I have, which I don't have much. No. I got some motorcycle, you know, some shit. But just give up everything and...
See, I've got a wife and a dog.
Yeah, yeah, you can't do that. And but they, I'm saying,
well, no. But what I'm trying to do is minimize. I think that, you know, perception is reality. You know, so if you've got things like you know, she lives in Connecticut, I live here, and we're trying to bridge, like, minimize the distance.
Yeah.
What I would like to do, to be honest, my dream, and you know, we said it the other day, man. There's a difference between success and fame. And I don't need to be famous, like face on billboard. If it happens, whatever. But I'd rather just be successful and happy. And I wouldn't mind having a little place here. And then I'd happily buy a few acres in Vermont.
Yeah.
Just a couple hours up the road and build a little cabin where me and my comedy friends or my family, we could just go cut down some trees and burn a fire and just get out and breathe some air and see stars.
Yeah, man.
And just decompress because, you know, man, we're not made for this shit.
Yeah, it's, you know, funny. It's funny because as I walk around each day, I go, man, there are some fucking people in this city.
Well, you're in a weird spot too because the East Village, I mean, like you and I, there's about a half mile distance between where you are now and my apartment.
Yeah.
And in between there is, there's a methadone clinic. There's like two men's shelters. There's the Ninth Precinct. There's and literally right across the street from my apartment is where the Fillmore East used to be.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, dude, that's the thing.
Wow.
So growing up, I've been a Dead fan.
I got to go over there. Look at that.
Take a walk over with me later.
Totally.
So I've been a fan of the Dead since I was probably 8 years
old. Can you show me the physical graffiti building also?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, that's cool. On St. Mark's and A. Yeah. We'll walk over there. I've been a Dead fan forever, and I always collected tapes. I used to go to conventions, and I found I called my local radio station, 99 Rock WPLR. They used to have Psychedelic Sunday.
Yeah.
And I called, and
what
I said,
"What year are we talking?"
This is 1990.
Before you get into this,
89.
Let's get into how you get into the Dead up to this.
So,
because I just got into the Dead. I told you, growing up, I was anti-Dead. And
which is the most Dead you can be.
Absolutely.
I love it. I love that you're so anti-Dead because I'm anti-Dave Matthews because it's just, I never even looked at that.
But
my era and, you know, all the girls in high school would go see him and, you know, it would just be finger blasting, you know, sorority chicks on the lawn.
Yeah. I found the Dead backwards.
Yeah.
Because I fell in love with the Mother Hips. And Black Crowes, once they get into the Amorica tour, you know, some 90...
Great album cover.
Yeah, Amorica, Three Snakes, the drug long jammy Horde tour.
Yes.
I get into some Blues Traveler. My band becomes kind of a jammy band, not in that way of more... I like the more of the Mother Hips jams where it was like really fucking, the jamming was different, you know?
Well, totally. And I mean, like, you know, I'm an enormous, and I'd love to tell that story. And I have to apologize to my listeners because I do tell this a bunch, but I'm glad to tell you.
Yeah.
Hot Rats to me is one of the greatest albums of all time. It's an early Zappa album. And that's jamming, but it's tight and it's,
that's nerd jam.
Yeah, but
it's
not
musical.
Even, yeah, like Willie the Pimp.
Technical.
And Peaches and Regalia. And it's just watching Zappa go off is just, you know, it's transcendent, you know? So my folks had me when they were in their late teens in 1979. When I was 3 months old, my folks split. Yeah. And when I was 8, they got back together and they had 3 more kids.
Whoa.
And they're still together and they're happier than ever. Yeah, it's wild.
What was that about? Just married too young?
I think so, dude. I think that, like, my dad just needed to grow up and my mom was born to be a mother and I don't have a sad look. My dad drank, but I'm not one of these fucking crybabies that's like, my dad drank. Yeah, of course he drank. He had a fucking kid at 18. I'm glad he wasn't blowing coke off the soft spot on my head. You know?
Yeah, like, yeah, right.
Good for him, he drank.
Like, who wasn't drinking?
Right? I mean, I would be. Damn it, man. Like,
I mean,
course.
I grew up watching All in the Family. He comes in, he has a drink, and says,
smoking
shut the
a
fuck
cigar.
Up.
Yeah, exactly.
That was, you think they made that up? No.
No,
Norman,
man, no.
You know,
I hate when people do that. When my dad, I mean, look, if he beat you or called you worthless, fine. You got a reason to cry. But come on, man. So, you know, anyway, my dad bought this little fixer-upper house, and Upstairs is where I lived. It was an old little Cape, Connecticut. It was a living room, a bedroom, and a tiny little bathroom. And in the living room is where my dad just put his shit. And in there was an old Technics rack system.
Yeah.
Big speakers, enormous can headphones, and milk crates full of records. And he had records that I couldn't. Now, I was just getting to know him. I didn't have anything to talk about with my dad.
Is when you're eight?
Yeah, we had just got back together as a family, and I didn't like him. Yeah. My memories pre him, it's like blue skies and kids running around, and then it's like
no rules.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden it's like dreary and gray.
Who's
and,
this guy coming in trying to be dad?
Yeah, all of a sudden I'm like nervous around this man, you know, and like yeah. I had uncles and a grandfather that were like fun. But look, I love my dad, and everyone's different, and what I've learned from him is you have the ability to change, you have the ability to start over, and he's done a phenomenal. He's a great dad.
Yeah.
I don't want to paint him as some asshole, but.
Yeah, I had Cantrell on. He wrote The Rooster and everything. Yeah. And he said that song brought him back in and bonded with his dad because he didn't know his dad, and his dad went to Vietnam and stuff.
Yeah,
and,
man.
My dad
tells me how proud he is of me, and we've got a great relationship. It's one of my I say it on stage. I go, I'm friends with my dad now, and I'm glad we waited.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, it's true. And we've got a good relationship. But anyway. He had these records, and he had hundreds and hundreds of records. And it was just me in this room. Next to me had all these records, and it was like this kind of like Telltale Heart, Pandora's Box type thing where I could just hear it. It wanted me to come listen to them. And I'm in this new house, and I feel uncomfortable, and I don't really know what to do. And he goes, look, here are the records you can listen to, and here are the ones you can't. And in the ones that I could not listen to was Black Sabbath, Frank Zappa, and the Grateful Dead.
Wow.
But the ones I could listen to, Dean, weirdly, was Zeppelin, The Who, David Bowie, Jethro Tull.
It's all the same.
Kiss, Bad Company.
Kiss.
Yeah, dude, it was so weird. And I just kind of, like, Talking Heads was in there. So when he was awake and everybody was up and about, I would play constant. I loved The Who, and that was my dad's favorite band. So I got to know, like, Quadrophenia and Tommy and Meaty, Beaty, Big and Bouncy and all these great like old Who albums.
Yeah.
Zeppelin I always really loved. I would play with the album covers. But when he went to bed, I'd throw the cans on and I would go to Sabbath and it was nighttime and I'm 8, 9 years old and I'd look at those album covers and I was scared to death.
Fuck yeah. And that shit is The Exorcist.
Dude, the minute, and at 8, 9 years old, I mean like the minute you put on that album and it starts crackling and popping. And then
The rain.
Then you hear that church bell and the
Or that general gather.
Yeah, I mean that first sound of like the rain. I'm getting chills talking about it. The rain and the church bell, like boom, boom.
That shit
I go
three notes.
I go, I'm done. I was
so
scared.
Scary.
I put it away. I put it behind Queen. Hid it. I'm like this woman. You open up the album cover and it's a lady. A lady in a white dress in a coffin with a cross, and I'm like, no.
Dad must have been an interesting, like, what was he like? Was he a stoner?
He was just kind of like this, rock. I picture him. He won't talk about. He gave up drinking, and he went one day just drinking and then religious. He just traded one for the other.
Wow, did
Real
he get
weird.
Rid of the Sabbath records?
Dude, he actually made me watch a video about how there's backmasking in rock and roll, and there's all these satanic messages in the albums that we used to listen to together.
Something scared him.
Something happened.
Something happened.
Know what it is, but anyway.
No one finds Jesus until something happens.
It's totally true,
that's
man.
That's a good bit. I'm going to do that.
Jesus is
you
like
know that.
He's like the conscience mafia.
Yeah.
Like he just shows up when you need him.
Yeah.
You know?
It's true. Either you get cancer or you go to prison. And whenever that happens, the person's like, you know, God's going to find his way. It's like, dude, God, you've been fucking huffing coke for 10 years. That's what got you cancer. Now you're looking for God? Idiot, man. Just ride it out. Call it a day.
That's it.
I'm fucking done.
Blame yourself. Take ownership.
Don't find religion all of a sudden, man.
It's so terrible because it's just this codependency with
I've never heard a guy go, God, cancer, found God, it went away. Yeah. Never heard it.
And you've never heard anybody go, found God, got cancer.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
never
happened. Yeah. Either way.
No one's ever blaming God for their cancer. Man.
That's a great bumper sticker. Shit has to happen before I find religion.
It's really right.
Bad shit.
Yeah, hit my car. I need to go to church.
Whenever someone starts preaching at me now, I'm gonna go, dude, what happened to you?
Dude,
you know what I mean?
I had a weird thing happen out of the blue the other day. I got a phone call from somebody I haven't talked to in years, and he goes, hey man, I just wanted to I've been sober for a year,
yeah,
and I just wanted to call and apologize, and if there's anything I did while I was drinking to hurt you. And he was going through his steps, and that's totally cool. And I'm like, dude, no worries, man. I'll love you forever. You never, you know, we used to party hard together,
right.
Him and I. He was there during a very dark time in my life, and he helped me through it, through strippers and drugs. And then he goes, you know, man, but I just wanted to know, and I'm really interested to hear what you think. And all of a sudden, his voice changes, and he goes, how would you feel about making more money? He goes, I would love for you to come to my house and listen to a 90-minute talk about selling Facebook ads to your comedy fans.
Wow.
And I'm sure that some of the guys that tell jokes with you would love to learn about how we can help boost their follower. And I'm like, no, you fucked up. You should have did this bullshit and then apologized.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? I'm like, good luck with sobriety, man, but don't you ever fucking pull that pitch.
That's crazy.
It was
right?
Terrible. Man.
I thought he was going to say, how do you feel about this? I've been wanting your ass.
Yeah. I've been pounding meat to your fucking. No. So, my dad, right? So, the Zappa, I go from Sabbath to Zappa. I loved Frank Zappa right yep. away. His voice tickled me. And I had a chance to tell his daughter on my show that, you know, I knew one day I would be friends with him. Musically and mentally, but I just wasn't ready yet.
Right.
It was too heady. It was like being a freshman in a senior Latin class, and I'm like, I need practice.
Zappa's a lot like how they say he's a comic's comic. Zappa's a lot like he's the musician's musician.
Super
you know?
Heady, and you know, man, yeah. I find some of it very unlistenable and very preachy, and I'm not into that stuff.
I'm dying to see the documentary. It played like a week, 2 weeks ago, right when I was starting the road, and I was bummed. It was gone in fucking 1 week, but I'll see it
on Netflix. I had the privilege to watch it, and yeah. anybody out there that, I mean, it's phenomenal, and it's all Zappa in his own words. There's no fluff.
Yeah, Maron told me it's fantastic.
It's really dynamite,
it's really
man.
Funny and
it's,
and great. It's,
he's such a brilliant guy, and what I love about him, he was filterless. And he was a Ken Kesey once called Jerry Garcia a sharp tongued popper of balloons. And yeah. I love that saying. And I think it fits Zappa well that like there was no bullshit. It's like, let's deflate this.
He's like the Bill Hicks of fucking music.
Yeah,
you know?
Man. Really?
It's just like, this is it.
Totally.
Eat dicks if you don't like it. It's interesting. It's an interesting time. I'd love to be filterless. Sometimes you have to filter yourself because
it's a shit world we live in.
It's rough, man. You'll just get fucking shut down not because of what you say, but clickbait. Mm-hmm. You know, they mm-hmm. just grab the 1 second and not the whole thing, and then that spreads around, and no one takes the time to figure out what the person really said. You know,
I think the only thing that comedians should ever have to apologize for is not being funny.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you go up with hate in your heart and you want to hurt someone, I don't think you belong on stage.
No.
If you're doing something to make people feel better about a terrible situation or a, you know, I have a quick bit that I do sometimes that leads into something about how I saw a woman with a 9/11 Never Forget shirt on, and it bummed me out because I just forgot.
Right.
And I'm like, I got to start forgetting all over again,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and it doesn't mean
yeah.
I'm, it doesn't mean it that wasn't one of the most.
It's funny. My only rule is I don't do 9/11 jokes, my own personal rule. And I think it was because it was the most brutal thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And even being here in New York, I walked up to the Freedom Tower a couple of days ago. Even being here in New York and the love that I feel from the comedy
community
and stuff.
Oh, man, totally.
I just, I, That's the only thing. But that's me.
Well, you know what it is?
People do them. I don't care.
What the next line I say is I go, we're such a weird culture because we're always reminded to remember the worst things.
Yeah.
That's the whole point. So you could literally.
No, I'm saying yours is great.
And I agree with you.
Yours is great. I'm talking about if somebody's talking about a dude jumping out.
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah, no.
That was a rough day. And as I sit here, like I said, you know, really close to where it happened.
Oh, dude, it's crazy.
I just couldn't imagine if I was sitting right here. In where we're at, and then that fucking smoke was blazing down the avenues.
Were you
living here?
I was in college, I was up at UConn, and it happened. And you know, I remember getting in my car, and I remember listening to the radio, and everyone had no idea if it was an accident, if it was terrorism, if it was, oh my God, a second plane just hit the second tower. This must be planned. There's no way there would be two mistakes. And then you're hearing all these different things about the Pentagon. And I was just driving. I don't remember driving. I felt like I was just floating.
Yeah.
Home. I was an hour from my parents. They're closer to here. And my dad works in Southern Connecticut. And he said they were carting people to the neighboring states because the hospitals were full. And I wanted so bad to come in and do anything to help. But what do you do? I mean, you couldn't have gotten into the sea. While people are running out, you know, young, headstrong me wanted to run in. But it to this day, man, and I will tell you, I mean, it's been, that happened how many years ago? But I, when I'm driving outside of the city, if I'm coming in from Brooklyn or Queens or Westchester, and I see a plane and I see the skyline, whether it's heading into LaGuardia or JFK or out of those, and it disappears behind a building, I still kind of get a little bit of a fucking twinge, like a twitch. Seeing it gets me like, it was really brutal. And I guess my theory on it all, or my thought on it all, is I really hate that we live in this society that sensationalizes atrocities.
Yeah, you're right.
I wonder what...
That's a great bit, though.
I wonder what this world would be like if instead of world star hip-hop, where kids are filming themselves beating the shit out of each other, or YouTube, where you could just see hate and anger, what if we lived in a world where people posted videos of you holding a door for a guy on crutches, or a lady drops her groceries and I pick them up? Imagine if we just lived in that type of a society where we were celebrating positivity, and we don't.
That's my
ideal little utopian.
As hippie as it is, it's I do love being edgy on stage and stuff, but like I told you yesterday, I don't feel any animosity towards anybody in this business or music business or anything. My hate goes towards cancer and heart attacks, and those are my enemies.
Time.
I got no enemies. Time, you know. Yeah. I don't have any enemies. If somebody doesn't like you for who you are, hey, that's how it is. You can't change who you are. But my point is, it's just like, we're here once. And we're, you and I are comedians, and it's fucking, it's just heaven to me, man.
Dude, I'll tell you, when I started late in, some people say late in life, but I started at like, I think I was either 29 or 30.
I started at 44.
Yeah. So you get it, man. It's like, and I had done 10 years of like a soul sucking sales job, and I had money, and I was miserable, and I was drinking, and I was treating people like shit. And I have periods of my life that I don't even necessarily would care to remember. And when I started doing stand-up, it was like a world within a world. Like when you're a stand-up and you live in New York City, you're in a city within the city. We have these little, I know the shortest distance from this club to that club. Yeah. I know that I could stop and get a coffee at this joint on the way to this bar show on this Tuesday. And I know how to get from the Cellar to the, Stand Up New York, which is from West Village to Upper West. And you see people along the way. And everyone else is kind of just a shadow. But if I see you from club to club, totally, we're like running our own race, and it's like, I'll catch you. Well, let's meet up.
I don't even know where I'm at in the city at all.
It's fun to learn, though.
People go like, where are you? I go, I'm over at the cellar, that street. You know, I don't know what the neighborhood is. I just know I pop in on my phone. It tells me the stop to get off, and I walk the four blocks.
It's crazy intimidating right off the bat.
It really is. You know, I've come here for years, and at one point, I learned the city pretty good, maybe back in 02. And I don't know it at all, and I enjoy that. I remember in 02, I bought like the, it was a postcard so I could see the city and understand the layout. This time, I don't even fuck around with it. I just, it's so weird. It's almost like time traveling. I get on a subway underground, and then I get out somewhere above ground, and to me, it's just the same fucking spot.
Yeah, totally.
It's same spot.
It's kind of almost...
leap shit.
right? Seriously. It's like the less you think, the better you do here.
Yeah.
You just kind of do. You just put it in like autopilot, and you just kind of follow, you know. And I some cities are very, very, like Boston to me is extremely confusing. Chicago is kind of like a little bit easier because there's a grid system. But New York's just kind of like, literally the compass for me.
Yep.
As long as you're going north or east or northeast or southwest or whatever, you can kind of find where to go. And I love it. I loved living in Denver. I love that open feeling, but at the same time, man, I worship that city, but it's just something that, like, it's not here, you know? And the beauty of doing stand-up on the road is you can go visit these great places and make friends and find, you know...
And leave by the time we're bored with it.
Yeah, totally, dude,
you know what I mean? I say this over and over. I land in a city and I go... I could live here. And by the third day, I go, I got to get the fuck out of here.
Fuck out of this place, yeah.
But on this run in New York, I have not once said I got to get the fuck out of here. Matter of fact.
Give it time.
I have. Oh, I understand. give it winter, everybody says. Because right now, I'm in the comfort of popping out of the subway and getting up on the street into the cool air where
I mean, dude, you're in a perfect... I mean, this area... There's a reason why this is one of the most expensive neighborhoods in the city. Because, I mean, you could pretty much get to any train... That leads you, you know, right now you've got the F right outside.
I get on the F, I get off.
Six
up there.
Blocks up, you've got the 6, the N, the R. I mean, you can be in Midtown in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
You came and did my show and it was Midtown. I mean, what'd it take you fucking 15, 20 minutes?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
To drive there would take an hour and a half just because of idiots. But
insane, right?
Yeah, it's bananas. It's really.
I literally went and did your show, and it felt like I was on the train for 5 minutes, walked up the stairs, and I was at your place. And like I said, had no idea where the fuck I'm at.
Right.
I just know the street address and I walked in, but I didn't know what part of town I'm at.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you shit.
You were right around the corner from Madison Square Garden.
Oh.
You were right around the corner from MSG. So, but I want to show you the Fillmore East and I want to show you these places. And what's great, so back to that Grateful Dead thing, the albums my dad wouldn't let me listen to, the only one that really like spoke to me right away was the Grateful Dead.
And which album was it?
The ones that I listened to first, I listened to Skeletons from the Closet first. I listened to Steal Your Face. I listened to Shakedown Street.
Oh.
I remember Mexicali Blues was like one of the first songs that like, it sounded to me like a bunch of like happy Mexican guys were dancing around with like big round guitars and women dance. It had a feeling of travel. And I'll abridge this, but I fell in love with the Grateful Dead. I started to study them. I wanted to know every single thing I could possibly know about the Grateful Dead. I learned about Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters when I graduated high school.
Acid test.
Yeah.
San Francisco.
I stole my mom's credit card when I was 14, and I bought tickets to the Dead in 95 at September 19th, 1995, Boston Garden. The tickets came in the mail. I already had the money for her, and my uncle was going to bring me and three of my friends. She said yes. He dies in August. Yeah. I never had the chance to see him. And I'm glad I never had a chance to see him because the era of Jerry that I would have seen, I feel like it would have spoiled it or soured it. And the fans.
I don't think so.
I don't know if I would have been.
I don't think so because it's
still very folklorish to me. And it's very.
I hear you. It's like me, you know, and I go and I saw Trey playing and it was just kind of like. But I think that everybody has their era of a band. Like, there's so many people that have different eras of every band whenever they find them. Like AC/DC, Joe Bartnick was like my favorite show ever. Was the ball breaker tour, and I was like, wow, really? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I think you would have saw the Dead, and that would have been your you already liked the Dead,
worshiped them.
Yeah, and, so and you're good.
And I tend to be a fan of bands' earliest stuff. I don't know what it is, but it's like I really dig 1977 Van Halen.
Oh, yeah.
I like raw, like I still have something to prove rock.
Well,
do you know what I mean by
era.
That? The hunger music.
And the creative is at the fucking top.
It's apex, and it's just, we're got to go for it, because tonight might be the night that, you know.
It's interesting, because it's opposite with comics. Usually their first special, you're like, yeah, it's
that's
pretty
good. True, man. Yeah, that's fun.
But, I mean, you know, Louis C.K.'s chewed up. By then, you're like, this guy's a fucking different comic. Same with, you know, Chappelle from the first special to the Fillmore one. You're like, wow.
I think there's two people that I've said out loud to hundreds of friends, can't wait to see their next special. It was Patrice and Geraldo.
Oh, man.
Midlife Vices is still to this day one of my favorites.
Elephant in the Room.
Elephant in the Room is just, I mean.
Unbelievable.
Phenomenal comedy. And I wanted those albums to go on longer. And Billy Burr is probably, I think him and Brian Regan and Dave Attell are my Mount Rushmore of comedy. And I love Louis. Love him. But, you know, I kind of have this thing where it's like, I love Louis. Everybody loves, you know, but for my money, I would pay still. And it's weird to say that because I'm probably two people removed from him. But I'd pay to see Bill. And I'd pay to see, you know, Brian and Dave Attell. I have the privilege of knowing and seeing. And it's an honor to be in, you know, the same city with him. But you're right about that. Like, you don't want to go... I love Shameless. I love Louis' album Shameless, and I love his half-hour HBO special because it started to turn to you know that growth period. And liking the Grateful Dead is like liking six different bands.
Yeah,
you know?
We talked about it yesterday, you know, with the dude.
David Gans. Yeah.
Yeah, he was like, when someone says they hate the Dead, he says, really? You hate country rock?
You hate
you
blues?
You hate psychedelic? You hate blues? You hate bluegrass? You hate fucking, you know,
yeah, straight up rock?
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, really, it's like, how can you hate everything? And it's.
But I did hate him.
No, of course. But you know what? You hated him the way that when I tell people that I've been to 215 Fish concerts, they go, man, you're one of them. And it's like, have you ever gone? Have you ever actually, do you know one fucking song, or is it just that you know a kid in high school who drove a Land Rover that happened to have a Fish sticker on it
it's
and you hate
them? It's amazing how fans can ruin a perception of a band, because to me it was a lot to do with Berkeley and Hate Street, Trustafarians, and hippie
just junky
kids
idiots
that had money and were just like, dude, I need a miracle.
I hate that shit, man.
That kind of stuff really can sour people on something they don't know. And now I fully admit that, like, I was wrong. But I did love, Working Man's Dead.
Yes.
I always loved Working Man's Dead, but I never went deeper into it, which is amazing. And here's how I started to love the Dead. One, of course, through the Mother Hips, but the Mother Hips brought me on Jam Cruise.
Nice.
We're going to Jamaica. They get me on free as their tour manager.
Nice.
They go, hey, you want to go on a trip, man, free? And I go, fuck yeah. They go, you'll just be our tour manager, we'll say. And I go, cool. And it was really an epic time in my life because... I had just done my first spot doing comedy, and I realized In a week, I'm going on Jam Cruise. I had the set on a dumb little recorder.
Nice.
Those things, those pocket voice recorders.
Like a mini tape, a micro cassette.
It wasn't tape.
Oh,
it was
I know what you mean,
one.
The little digital ones. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I remember I'd just done the improv. It was like this, so you want to do comedy thing. It was my first spot, and I was leaving onto the ship, and I was very excited. I realized this is going to be a new thing in my life. I'm going to do comedy.
Yeah.
And I played it for Greg, who's the guitar player in Mother Hips. And I remember playing for him, and he was laughing in our little shit cabin where we slept right next to each other like fucking, you know,
sardines. Yeah,
like,
totally.
But I remember he took me upstairs, and he goes, let's go see Dark Star Orchestra. They're playing tonight. And Mother Hips played two shows on the cruise, but they weren't playing until the next couple of days. So we go upstairs into this big, badass theater in this ship, you know. And they come on, and he goes, yeah, I knew what Dark Star Orchestra was, but I didn't know the whole thing. And he goes, they play a concert, a famous concert from an era. So we're sitting there waiting for them to come on. They open with Shakedown Street. And it starts on, I'm hearing the T-wah, like, you know, whoa, whoa.
Yep.
And I was like, wow, this is cool. And it had this funky groove. And I'm like, what's this, man? In my mind, he's like, it's Shakedown Street. This is a great one.
Yeah.
And right then was really the door opened for me. And my mind was ready for some Dead.
Yeah, man.
And right at
great,
that moment.
And it's great that, you know, it hits us when we're ready. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think I have found certain music. I came across jazz that way, where when I was a kid, I was like, man, this is just fucking noise. And then it got to a point where my life was noisy, and I needed something that was a little bit of an escape. And jazz took me to a place where I didn't need to think. I could just let the music kind of play, and it didn't have to make sense, and it didn't need to have a beginning and an end. I could just step in. It was almost like a shower. You know, and like when you find music and music finds you at a certain point in your life, it really is more meaningful. Do you know what I mean?
Like, absolutely.
If you were forced and spoon-fed the Grateful Dead early on, you'd be like, I'm doing it because my buddies are doing it, but I'm not into it.
Yeah.
And I applaud you for being so hateful of the Grateful Dead.
It's hilarious, too, because my buddy works for the Dead. Yeah. I told you the story yesterday. I'll show you the pictures of me on stage
so
at
great,
Boulder.
Man. Yeah.
Just imagine if I was into him back then. I would have been at every show, like, free.
And you probably wouldn't be doing stand-up.
It's so true. Yeah. It's so true.
So everything happens for a reason.
I feel on that ship was just the next phase of my life. Here was this jam music, and here was my new comedy, and my mind was opening up to, like, yeah, man, I'm going to take some chances.
You know what's so funny is it was right about the time that I started doing stand-up, and I was living in Denver. We had a little place. My buddies and I had a place in Breckenridge. I snapped my humerus bone snowboarding.
Yeah,
see,
look
I've
at
got that,
that
scar.
Fucking scar.
Yeah,
it's like one of those 30s scar, Frankenstein.
Yeah, style. Really, dude. It's
straight
like,
up like a centipede.
It's like a deflated football. Yeah, really.
Yeah, man.
So I snapped it, and I had to have a plate and 8 screws put in, and they took my bicep out and all this awful shit. I came home and sat on my mother's couch and ate Vicodin and chicken parm for like 6 months. I was in the worst place I've ever been in. I got back, I got better, and Fish played 4 nights at Red Rocks. So we went back out. All my buddies stayed at my place. We're at Red Rock seeing Fish. Bill Kreutzmann from the Dead comes out. My buddies are feverish, like, let's go front row. Let's do, like, let's get as close to the band as possible and get sweaty and rub arms with everybody. And I was right with them. But I took a mushroom chocolate. And for those that don't know what that is, it's like they melt down psilocybin and put it into, like, a dark chocolate square. And it's really great. But I had a couple
it's
drops.
Diabetes psychedelic style.
It's psychedelic. Yeah, totally. And I had a
psychedelic.
I had a couple drops of liquid acid put on it.
Wow.
So I ate this down.
Holy shit.
Yeah,
man.
I don't know what I was thinking, but I went way up front. Now Red Rocks is
it's the best on the planet.
It's really the most amazing place to ever go. You can go there during the day when there's no concerts.
I went hiking
and
there.
Hiked down, run the stairs. You can go on stage.
It's unbelievable. I stood on the stage.
Yeah, I brought my little brother as a surprise, and we brought our guitars, and we played together and we played Grateful Dead songs, and he was so happy and I was so happy to see him do it. But anyway, we're at this show and we're cramming down in the front, and I'm really, really coming on. The acid's like, you know, and it was really nice blend. It was clean, but I felt like waves of people were like crashing over me, and I felt very claustrophobic, and I felt good, but I felt like I could feel better. And it's so akin to what you said about being on the cruise. 'Cause what I did was I looked behind me and I go, there seems to be a little bit more room, like 10, 15 rows back.
Yeah.
And I went back there and I stood back. And every time I got further from the stage, I felt good because I had more room, but I was opening up room for a new person. And then I went 20 more rows back and more people went forward. And I went all the way to the very back row and I leaned against the wall. And if you know Red Rocks,
yep,
you could see downtown Denver. The sound is better the further back you are.
It really is.
And when you look back, you're on a hill and there's people hiking up in the mountains. And I realized, this is where I belong now. Like, that's my childhood, is racing to the front and being a fandom, fanatical. I need to watch their faces. And this is me now. I've graduated to another level of my musical appreciation, being at an event, being at, you know, being comfortable just as my new place in this arena at this moment. And to this day, I think about it a ton, because my favorite place to sit at a show is a couple rows back behind the stage and watching people watch the band.
Yeah.
And it's fun to let... That's a kid's space right there, man, and that's great. And my buddies still do it. I had a pit ticket for Fish this summer, and I went down there for a minute, and the pit was like an open... It's like the areola of the amphitheater.
Yeah.
And it's right in front of the stage, and everybody wants to suck that nipple, you know? And yeah. I wanted nothing to do with it. I went there, and I'm like,
I enjoy a good seat now.
Dude, me too, man. Get me near the beer, the pretzel, and the pisser, and I'm happy.
The pisser, man.
But I had a moment, like you had on that cruise, where it's like, this is a new chapter in my life, and I'm cosmically comfortable not being that young kid that had to be front row or else I missed out. You know what I mean?
I
like watching people have fun.
I feel like out at sea, you know, I was out at sea and we were just cruising. It was the middle of the fucking night and Zappa Plays Zappa was on stage.
So good.
And I was at the very top of the boat where you could see far and look down and everything. And it was, I never really told this story before, but as hippie as this sound, I was like, I'm ready to go. I'm at peace right now. I'm ready to get into the fucking grind of comedy.
Yeah.
Which was about to start.
Yeah. I started right after Red Rocks. It's amazing.
Grind of comedy, you know, 3,000 spots later.
Yeah.
I think back to that spot on the ship and I could have easily just said that was fun doing that one spot of comedy at 44 years old. I did that, but no, I was diving in.
I think it's hilarious to think about the things we did early on. You know, I felt right away like I was up against the clock.
Yeah.
And I had my back against the wall, and I would see younger, fresher, hipper, whatever. Maybe not funnier, but hey, you know, like you said, I've got no hate and we're all in this together. But I always felt like I had something to prove.
Oh, me too.
And I felt like music, it's hilarious that looking back, I remember I had a set at Caroline's, and I was pacing back and forth in the hallway blasting Working Man by Rush.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favorite songs of all time.
That's a great tune.
When that breaks into that jam in the middle, and it's just, I mean, talk about underrated musicians. And I'm pacing.
Talk about another band I hated growing up, because I couldn't stand it. Why the dying? A wicked mind. Oh, yeah. You know, today's Tom Sawyer.
Feeling inside me said it's time I was gone.
I was just like, hey, ease up on the Dungeons and Dragons there, man.
That's so great.
Space Invasion, it's by only. Now I love Moving Pictures.
Oh, man. Yeah.
I loved it back then.
2112, the whole
but I was just like,
little
fuck
closet
that.
Shit. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Chronicles, the first disc on Chronicles is probably one of the best start to finish discs on a great you know, but I'm with you and I'm pacing and I'm like, it was like I was in the tunnel getting ready to play in the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Just to get on stage.
Totally.
And that's so wrong, because it's like I got up there and they're sitting and they're laughing. And I'm up there all of a sudden like, what's going on, everybody? You ready to have a good time?
Jacked.
And it's just fucking jacked to the gills, and I'm all fired up, and I'm and my energy didn't match theirs.
Yeah.
Which when you do stand up, it's such a fragile, you know, the more comfortable and at peace you are with yourself on stage, everyone's more than willing to take the ride with you.
The more confident.
If they have to adapt and react.
I feel like I'm even a different guy right now in New York, you know?
Yeah, totally.
I'm taking it slower. Mm-hmm. The rooms are smaller.
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes in L.A. you're doing a bigger room. You're a little bigger. I remember seeing Louis on the Oddball tour, and I was like, whoa, Louis's big on this on this tour. Well, you got to be. It's fucking 30,000 people or whatever, you know?
Yeah, like just this. I was laughing with Oakerson about this the other day. This weekend I did, you know, 5,000-seat Grand Theater at Foxwoods, sold out every show. 15 minutes opening up for the Impractical Jokers, and it was easy. Not, I don't want to say easy. It's a different comfort.
It's a different animal.
It's a totally different animal. And then I came back here, and the first show I think I did was to like seven people in a bar.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's such a soberingly weird.
Oh, yeah.
And he was talking about opening up for Jim Jefferies at Carnegie Hall. And then he had to race down to Village Underground, and he's like, he goes from this uproarious, like, he's like, everybody, thank you so much. And like, you could feel it rattling in your chest, the way that people are roaring.
Yep.
And then he's standing in a subway next to a rat.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's the highs
Same
and lows
with
of comedy,
me.
Man.
I do an arena with Russell Peters. We fly home on a fucking private jet, and then get off, and I'm at an open mic in fucking Burbank. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and that, I think you need to do that right away because that isn't our draw.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to remember that right away. I was lucky to open for these guys that have a massive draw.
I'll tell you what, you know. And I've been doing, and I talk about this, the people who listen to my show are probably so sick of hearing about it, but I've been doing transcendental meditation for 4 years.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think that the thing I've learned is that if you can somehow figure out a way to go through whatever you're doing egolessly, it's so much more enjoyable. You're so much more helpful and compassionate towards other people, and you can really appreciate the moments better. When I'm hosting a show, it's not my show. I'm the leadoff batter. I got to get on base.
Yep.
If I'm featuring, I got to just do. I love doing crowd work, but Jay is the king of crowd work.
Yep.
Why am I going to step on his shit?
Don't ever do that.
You know what
right?
I'm saying? Yeah. So it's these things that are inherently, we know it because we're men.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that against women. We're not boys, is what I'm saying.
Right,
I don't mean that like, you know, women know
it
too.
We're not beginners.
But you know what I, that's what
you
I mean.
Learn right away.
We're mature. Maybe is a better word for it. And speaking of clickbait, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's interesting to know, like when I go do the show with the Impractical Jokers, I mix it up every show. I don't have to go up and do the same set, but I'm not going to go try something that's half cocked and throw in dirty, whatever, because you know what? Their fans paid fucking top dollar to see this show that they love. And these guys are giving me the chance of showcasing myself to 5,000, 10,000 new people every night.
Yeah, totally.
So take advantage of that opportunity. And you know, we were talking, I took a picture backstage at Hampton Beach Casino Ballroom. Okay. And on the, I want to show you this, and maybe if you want it, we could post it up or something, but this picture is backstage. Okay. And I took that off the wall.
Oh yeah.
If you could possibly read, it says,
The people that played there
since 1922,
Talking Heads, The Strokes, U2, my boys, the Wallflowers, Ziggy Marley. Look at this, man. It's like Zeppelin. Wow. Skinner, Motorhead,
Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah. Hendrix, Janis Joplin, you know, fuck it. Yeah.
Like George Carlin.
Pretty much everyone, you know.
ZZ Top. I mean, look at, you name it. And then to come to find out that, like, Bob Weir played there the night Jerry Garcia died.
Oh, yeah.
And from that stage announced to the crowd that he lost his big brother. And here I am, how many years? 21 years later.
Yeah.
Doing stand-up. And I wore that tape out of that show. The owners of the place told me that. And I had tears in my eyes, man.
Yeah.
Like, when I went up on that stage, I go, like, I need to do this room honor. And there's certain places, and I wanted to ask you this, seeing that we both have the same respect for music and performing and our art, are there some rooms that when you walk in, you kind of go like, this place has magic?
Absolutely. I think the biggest one of my comedy career right now was Burr had me open for him at the Long Beach, it's Long Beach Event Center, or I forget what it's called now, where Pryor shot the famous special.
Oh, wow.
The one, in you know, where he's talking about the bear, like, did you bring the gun? The best Pryor special, live in concert, it's called.
Yeah.
And not Sunset Strip, right before that. And I could see how much it meant to Burr, and I hope he could see how much it meant to me that I got to do it with him, because I took that shit serious. I didn't around at all. When I walked on, and just like Burr, we both walked on, there it was. Because you see the theater in the special because the people are running to get seated and stuff.
Yeah.
That room had, like, it was insane to me. And then also Davey Symphony Hall in San Fran, because it was a room, I grew up in San Fran and in the Bay Area. It was a room I'd never even been in my life. I drove by every day of my life.
Yeah.
Every day I drove by this building, and I never went in because it was the symphony, and I was like, I was rock and roll. Fuck the symphony, you know?
Right.
And when I went in there, I opened with a bit. It used to be a bad neighborhood behind there. I've never been in here, but I've smoked crack behind here. You know, and I got this great huge bit.
That's hilarious.
Those two rooms, and of course, playing music, I headlined the Fillmore, and I played the Fillmore a bunch. Playing the Fillmore, I think, out of everything I've ever done, is the most magic. Standing on the wood there and seeing the chandeliers and the post. I got a poster on the wall in there. My name's on the wall in there a couple times.
When I come out and visit you, I want to go there. You got to bring me there because that to me is this, you know, like yeah. Being, I was walking down Second Avenue when I first moved here. Now, I've been coming to New York City. I grew up 40 minutes up the road, an hour up the road, but I didn't know this neighborhood. And I used to listen to, you know, 1970 Fillmore East Dead shows with them and the New Riders and
the Allman Brothers.
So I'm walking down Second Avenue and this like rhinestone thing hits my eye and it says Steal Your Face. And I walk over and there's Janis Joplin, Mountain, the Allman Brothers, Black Sabbath, The Doors, Jimi Hendrix, Frank Zappa, you name it, all over this pole. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? And then I look across the street and it says Bill Graham Way. So the Second Ave between 6th and 7th is Bill Graham Way.
Wow.
So right,
I gotta go over there.
Yeah,
today.
It's right there. And then I turn around and I'm looking at this building and I'm like, is this the fucking Fillmore East? And it's an Apple Bank and Trust now. And you walk in the lobby and they've got pictures and there's a plaque on the wall outside that says this is the historical landmark home of the Fillmore East. And I had a book, I still do, called The Art of the Fillmore East. And I ran home and I looked at it and I brought it out into the street and I took a look at the building and I'm like, the Jerry Garcia totally just stood, like, he definitely hung out and smoked cigarettes right here.
Totally.
Frank Zappa sat on these steps and probably talked guitar with Jimi Hendrix. And
the iconic record of Allman Brothers. I mean,
yeah,
that is the fucking record.
It's a tiny little room right there. If you go there,
I'm going.
So
there.
That's amazing where it's like, in your mind, you have these, like, you know, when I pictured Bob Weir talking about Jerry dying at the Hampton Beach Casino Ballroom,
yeah,
I never put it together that was that room. And 21 years later, here I am, telling jokes to four sold out crowds. And I'm good friends with the guys on, you know, I'm a writer for the show and all that. And they could, you know, Sal was like,
what is the show real quick?
Impractical Jokers?
Yeah, I know. What it is, Sal is from, he came out
doing stand up. Yeah. So it's on True TV and it's four good buddies from Staten Island. And essentially what happens is it's kind of like a punishment challenge type show where, you know, they've got earpieces and three out of the four guys are off stage and they tell one guy what to say and do. And if he doesn't do it, he loses or gets punished, and then they have a big punishment. It's
you mean it's like a like he's on this man on the street and they say do this or that or something to people, like, you know, interview him and stuff.
But the
like
goof
that.
Is always on them. It's never on the civilian.
I got you.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's feverish. It's got, you know, we have close to, I think it's like 50 or 60 million views a week.
Wow.
It's on its sixth season.
Really?
It's one of the funniest shows on television. It is. And I'm not, you know, impartial because I'm fucking writing stuff,
right,
but
right, right.
I love it. I love them. It's their fan. It's I'm part of something I could be really proud of. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I could see a lot of people watch it because we did Caroline's
dynamite.
A couple
yeah.
nights ago, or not Caroline's,
Gotham.
Gotham.
Yeah,
it was me, Big J, Sal, and Sean Patton, and when Sal went on, the people fucking knew him, you know?
Oh, yeah. People
and,
love him.
And I know who he is as a comedian, but I didn't know, I don't know the show.
It's funny, you know, we like at the live shows, they go, now we're going into season six, right? And at every show at the end, the guys ask, hey, who, just out of curiosity, how many of you are seeing us for the first time?
Yeah.
And 99.9% of the place erupts. So it's growing and it's great. But I went backstage and I was talking to the guys and I'm like, do you guys realize the, you know, and I've done probably 40, 50 big theaters across the country with these guys now, you know, yeah. 4,000 or 5,000 seaters. And that room to me was like, this is something special, man. You know, like there's, and they said the musicians that walk in that room go, I feel something.
Yeah.
It's like these happy ghosts are
you
hanging out.
You definitely feel
there.
That at the Fillmore.
Totally. Webster Hall is a room that I really, Jay's filmed a special there, and it's got an incredible vibe. It's like the room wants to be played.
Well, my dream is to do Red Rocks.
Oh, God.
You know,
yeah.
I don't even care if it's sounds terrible, you don't hear the laughs or whatever, but I never got there as a musician.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And then I wanted to shoot my special at the Fillmore, but it's a union room and it'd be a fucking $200,000 special. Mm. So my dream got squished there.
Well, you know, there's always the next special.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you do
oh,
great
yeah,
on the
oh,
first
totally.
One.
Totally. I'm yeah. saying the, yeah, yeah.
The first one, though. Yeah.
I will do it, you know, somehow.
Comedy rooms, you know, have that same thing. And to be honest, I think, I know Zany's in Chicago has got that history, but Punchline in San Fran.
Awesome.
When I went in that room, and you know, Molly and everybody there is so wonderful. And I mean, I'm a Steve Martin disciple.
Yeah.
And I just to know, you know, how much he was there and how much some of the certain places you just get on that stage and it's like some weird invisible thing is just passing you. Like a history book, and you're
I
signing your
Robin
name
Williams,
in it.
Robin Williams, man.
Robin Williams, yeah, exactly,
city,
exactly.
You know?
You know, and it's just a
Bobcat. Bobcat.
It's where comedy started. You
yeah.
know, and you know, same with Zany's in Chicago. That club's 78. So
comedy
it's
works in Denver.
Oh yeah,
shit.
Heliums are great. I mean, there's some rooms that just really, really, you know, punch you in the face when you know and. Yeah, like I said, I mean, I'm going to have the, you know, tomorrow I'm going to be, in, you know, auditioning at the Cellar, which is, you know, Mount Olympus.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about that and then
oh
get
boy.
Out of here.
All right.
You're, I was passed at the Comedy Store, I think almost 4 years now.
Nice.
It happened
congrats.
November 27th, 4 years ago coming up here.
Yeah.
Can't even believe how fucking.
It's yeah, great though, man.
Yeah. But
you're a very funny guy.
I really, thanks, dude. I really understand, and I don't think anyone will really understand, unless you're a comedian, what it meant to be passed there, because there's a few things in my career that have really been unbelievable. One being on WTF, the other one being passed at the Comedy Store, that really hold serious fucking weight in the business. And the third would be being passed at the Cellar, meaning wherever you go in America, people always, this is how they gauge you right away. They go, what's your homeroom?
Yeah.
And if your homeroom somewhere jive, they just move on. But if you say Comedy Store or the Cellar, immediately they go, Comedy Store or the Cellar? Really? Mm. Immediately it holds so much weight that they go, oh yeah, you want to do a spot?
Dean, I think that the thing that I'm maybe overly passionate about is respect. And I think that, you know, I would love to talk to Marc Maron about my time living with Ken Kesey. And I would love to talk about, you know, interviewing my heroes and all that. And the Comedy Cellar is, to me, something that you earn. And it's something that you take seriously. And it's something that, especially since Louis now.
Yeah.
To me, it holds this thing where, like, you know, I told Oakerson a while back that I go, whenever you think the time's right, you know, and we talked and, you know, explained, you know, we had a good conversation. Him and I are best friends. And he said, yeah, man, let's do it. Let's take, you know, any.
How do you do it? Two guys recommend you, one guy?
I mean, I think it doesn't hurt to have a couple people. I don't know, man. And it's kind of almost one of these things where it's like, I feel like George Steinbrenner was like, maybe we want this guy on our in our bullpen.
Well, people ask me the same thing. How do you get past at the store? You know, and you're just, like,
yeah, I mean,
Jay
recommended me, and I know, you know, a couple other people threw in kind words and said that they thought I was funny, whatever. But to me, it's like, you know, it's like digging into the batter's box at Wrigley Field or the old Yankee Stadium or
have you gone on in there at all? Because at the store, you can go on in the building on bringer shows and stuff. And mics.
I've been in the room 1,000 times. I've been, have I stepped on that stage ever? No.
Wow.
And I wonder about maybe tonight popping in there and being like, did I leave my phone? You know, and just, but no, it's something that, you know, I've been preparing for it. And the prestige of it all, yeah, I love, but I've kind of got landscaper brain where it's like, you know, there's sets to be done in this city,
yeah,
and I want to do them.
Yep.
And I'm not fucking around. You know what I mean? When I go up there, I'm delivering the best I possibly can, no matter if it's, you know, at the stand late night at a guest spot, stand up New York, in Queens at a bar show, you know, I'm performing for my life.
Yep.
And I'm very honored to have the opportunity to do that club. And yes, you know, saying, you know, I'm a seller comic and things like that, is so important. But really what I want to do is I want to be able to kind of keep that torch lit and hopefully put my stamp on comedy, the timeline that we're living in.
Yeah.
We've stepped on this kind of, you know, people mover,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
where it's like it began when it began. And, you know, I grew up with Monty Python and Benny Hill and, you know, SCTV and early Saturday Night Live with Bill Murray and Belushi and Archie Bunker and yeah, you know, Odd Couple.
We're the same dude.
And, yeah, man.
It's
and it's, you know, and then music.
Cheech and Chong and fucking, yeah, you know, and Chico and the Man and fucking
Sanford and Son. Red Fox, man,
Son.
Is just, you know,
come
all
on,
that great comedy. And then, you know, as you start to age and you start to find what you love, I mean, Dave Attell and Geraldo and Colin and watching Tough Crowd. And to me, that's comedy. And that's that, you know, and I've gotten to know through working, I've had the privilege to work with Sebastian Maniscalco and Bobby Kelly and Voss and, you know,
awesome,
Jay and Ari and all these guys that took time to look me in the eyes and go, you're funny, you're going to be all right.
Yep.
And there are times that I don't know if people understand how many sleepless nights there are pacing around going, how the fuck do I make this work?
Yeah.
How do I make this? Is it too late? Am I not funny enough? Am I just another white dude?
Yeah.
And then
I say that shit every time.
It's fucking terrible, man.
Every day. And it's like, what do you mean they're not looking for another white guy? You know, it's like, why does race have anything to do with it? Why does age have to do with it?
Sex has nothing to do with it.
Why does anything have to do with anything except for hard work and funny?
And that's and there's our purest, you know, thing. And
it's
yeah. So to have it all, you know, there's a line in Black Peter, which is a Dead song, where, you know, Jerry sings, "See here how everything leads up to this day."
Yeah.
And it's just like any other day that's ever been. And it's, I think about that a lot, that everything has led up to now, and I'm so goddamn excited to have the opportunity to go do a couple minutes at that club. And if she likes me, I'll be honored to call myself a seller comic. If it doesn't go well, hey, you know, there's always another time.
If it doesn't go well, do you get to do it again later?
Yeah, but I'm not going to even give that. I'm saying that as
I'm just getting the process.
I believe that there's, I don't know. Yeah. And you know, part of me, a practice that I've been trying to implement and it's been going well is to, just kind of worry about myself. I don't pay a lot of attention to gossip, to how people do things or what's happened with other people. Everyone has their path. Because I think I had a problem early on about seeing things on Facebook or on posts of, hey, I'm doing this show, and it would keep me up all night. And I'd be like, why can't I do that?
I used to be like that too.
So I unfollowed every single friend on Facebook. Yeah. I don't follow one from Attell to my little sister. I've blocked. Now Facebook to me is a news feed, and I get like Jay Blakesburg photos and fish news and Playboy and the Grateful Dead and meditation
Fuck
and
Facebook,
Yankees.
Man.
It's my newspaper now.
So
you know what
jive.
I mean? It's such garbage. But you know,
waste book.
Seriously, yeah. Fuck your Facebook.
You know, I think it's, and as much as our peers will tell us, man, don't worry, everybody has their own path. And you hear it over and over and over, and then eventually you start to go, yeah, you're right. You know, you have to sit back and take it in. Yeah, stuff hurts. Stuff hurts when you don't get stuff or you're not doing stuff and other people are doing stuff.
Have you ever had a moment on stage, and I know we have to wrap up, but have you ever had a moment on stage where you have that millisecond of complete bliss where you're looking out at the room and it's just a room of people wall to wall laughing at something you thought of, and it almost is going in slow motion?
Oh.
And for a second, just for a second, you're able to go, I'm really fucking doing it, man. You know? And it's fleeting, and you can't stay in that bliss because then you're fucked. But you can really for a minute go back and be like, it's almost kind of like Arnold flexing his muscles and pumping iron, you know? It's just like you can, you realize like, I'm going to be okay.
Well, I tell myself all the time when people go, well, you don't have a special, you didn't go to Montreal, you didn't. And now what I tell myself is, you know what though? I'm a paid regular at the Comedy Store at 50 years old.
You're doing it.
I got a podcast in the top 100. I just did 2 weeks on tour with Alice in Chains and 29 shows at the Stand.
Six years in.
I'm doing it.
Same
I've
here,
already
man.
Made it.
Yep.
I've said it over and over. I've already made it. This other shit is just, wow, bonus.
100%, man. And I think that that's the thing that we have that will make it enjoyable for us and for the people who love us is that we appreciate it. And
totally.
We're working hard, and it's a breath of fresh air to a lot of people, I think. You know,
it is,
what I mean?
It is, man. It
a lot
is.
Of people
I can tell by the emails I get on this podcast. They're like, I love your positivity, and, you know. And my whole thing is, it's never too late. As corny as it sounds, I started at 44. If you had a dream to fucking, you know, ride a motorcycle across country or skydive or start your own business, whatever your dream is, if the reason you're putting it off makes no sense to me, because you're alive still, and whatever it is, just go fucking do it.
I want to die. Well, who the hell said it? Die drunk, sliding into, you know, the grave, going, man, what a ride.
Yeah,
you know, I don't ever want to lay there with tubes in my arm, going, oh, I wish I did more comedy.
Well, I got ran over on my motorcycle. And everybody goes, yeah, man, was it like slow motion as you were sliding down about to die? And I was like, it was fast motion. And the only thing I remember is no regrets.
That's awesome.
No regrets.
That's awesome, man. We are the same person. When I was 25, I had blood clots in my lung and I almost died from it. And I laid in the hospital and I realized I need to live. Like I need to, you know, everything I do from this point forward is about enjoyment.
Tim McGraw, live like you were dying.
Oh, yeah. Jesus Christ. What a way to end it with some fucking country. Dean, I love you, man.
I love you too,
you're
man.
Really
let's go look
great.
At that Fillmore.
Yeah, let's do it, man. Let's go
all
take
right.
a walk.
So Jamcast, it'll be on Jamcast
yes.
and Let There Be Jam Talk, Let There Be Talk. In a couple weeks or whatever, release it. I can even release mine on a Monday, you on a Friday.
Oh,
whatever.
I don't care. I'll do whenever.
Yeah. And yours is where?
You could find it at Jamcast Pod on Twitter. It's Jamcast on iTunes. And you can find me at Mike Fenoia, MikeFinoia on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. And all my dates are at MikeFinoia.com.
And for those of you tuning in, my podcast is Let There Be Talk. It's on iTunes and Bill Burr, Al Magical's network, all things comedy, and also SoundCloud. And I'm going to be all over. I'll be headlining Wise Guys in Salt Lake and House of Comedy in Arizona. And also...
I feel like this is just the beginning of friendship.
We're going to be talking some fucking dead.
Hell yeah,
you know,
dude.
I mean? It's tough to talk dead around my friend. Like, Maron's like, fuck, enough of the dead. You're like a deadhead now. He was like, fully like, you're like a full-blown deadhead now.
He's so probably so happy about
well,
it.
Well, we were in Denver, you know.
Yeah.
No, I think he's like, he already went through his dead. He's a dead guy, but he went through it years ago.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's like when somebody like comes up to me and goes, man, I've been watching Breaking Bad. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about, dude? You know how long ago that I've been telling you to watch Breaking Bad since the day it came out.
It's like, yeah, dude, the Wonder Years is fucked, man. Yeah. I love that
it
show.
It seems Breaking Bad or The Sopranos.
Oh, people, yeah, totally.
And now it's going to be Boardwalk Empire. And that other show.
Orange is the New Black.
The Wire.
The Wire.
People are like, I love The Wire. And it's like, wasn't that like 15 years ago? Yeah, yeah, it's great. But what stumbled onto it? Did your appendix get taken out and you were home? All right, let's get out of here, man. See you guys later.
Adios.